Take a network break. Grab a virtual donut as we traipse through this week's tech news, sprinkling analysis and commentary like so much powdered sugar over a sweet confection. This week's show is sponsored in part by Nokia. Did you know that Apple is using Nokia's data center fabric solution? If you want to know more and learn about Nokia's SR, Linux, and fabric services platform for yourself, check it out at nokia.com/networks/DC-fabric. We're also sponsored today by Linode. Linode's Linux virtual machines let you develop, deploy, and scale your modern applications in the cloud faster and easier. You can get started on Linode today with $100 in free credit for listeners of the Network Break podcast. All the details are at linode.com/networkbreak. Last but not least, we've got a brand new Ignition course. It's Learning BGP with Russ White. The first module is on BGP Basics. That's published. It's up and available with more to come. Ignition's $99 a year. You get exclusive instructional videos, white papers, columns, and more. And speaking of which, Greg, you also have a new podcast with Keith Townsend. It's called Heavy Strategy.
Yeah, that's where Keith and I take one issue from a design or an IT strategy perspective and deep dive on it. Just in the moment, working through the edit for a show where we talk about SAP and whether you could migrate SAP to the cloud. Keith was an SAP consultant for a number of years and worked for one of the big five consulting firms. And it's going very well. We're into our sixth episode. We're starting to settle into the stride, I think. And people who listen are giving us some good feedback and telling us how we can improve the show. Maybe you'd like to join in and listen to it as well. You'll just search for it as a Heavy Strategy. It doesn't appear in any Packet Pushers feed. So if you're subscribed to the Fat Pipe and or the full feed, you won't see it. It is independently offered a separate track because we don't want to overload those channels with any more shows. So you'll have to subscribe to Heavy Strategy. Just search for Heavy Strategy on your favorite podcatcher and you'll find us there.
Yep, or check it out at packetpushers.net. It's there too. All right, let's dive into the news. The big news this week is that Salesforce is going to spend $27.7 billion to acquire Slack, the workplace chat and collaboration application. Salesforce isn't fooling around. It says it's going to deeply integrate Slack into Salesforce Cloud and that Slack will be, quote, the new interface for Salesforce Customer 360.
Do you get that smell? Like that's the smell of, you know, like sewage, like the bloviation coming off this acquisition from Mark Benioff at Salesforce was astonishing.
There was a lot of self-congratulation in the
like lots of like many. And in the follow-up interviews, he made a range of outrageous statements. So I'm just going to go straight to the one that caught my eye. And he said in an interview on CNBC, he said, I get to look right. And the CNBC interviewer said, why are you buying Slack? He said, I get to look right out my window. Do you know what I see? The Slack logo, because the Slack building is right next to my building. And I'm looking into their building all the time. The idea that these two great companies are right next to each other in Salesforce Park is amazing. It's a perfect match for both of us that's going to extend our companies, make us both stronger. And look, we've spent more than a decade focusing on this vision we've had for the social enterprise. At this point, you'd think he's spending $27 billion buying Slack because it's in the building next door. Just like, okay. So he feels the need to really sell this. Like he doesn't feel like he's on solid ground. You read all of the context that he's put out there. And I definitely get a sense of, oh, he's really working hard because he doesn't, you know, I think he's overpaid. The market thinks he's overpaid. He's paying 27 times the 12-month trailing revenue. This isn't 12 times the valuation or 12 times revenue or whatever it is. This is 12 times a trailing revenue. Just to get a sense of scale, Tesla, which is the hottest of speculative bubbles on the US stock exchange at the moment, is valued at 9 times trailing 12-month revenue. So he's really, really overpaid. Salesforce shares fell 6% so far. I believe they'll go down a little bit more. Slack share price, of course, popped up quite tidily because they got bought. I mean, like for 300% more than what it was listed for the day before. So an amazing deal in the sense that just how much money Salesforce is paying for this. And, you know, Mark Benioff, who's normally a fairly rational person, is bloviating way more than normal. So I'm pretty sure he's on thin ground here on that basis.
That's interesting. I mean, from Slack's perspective, I see this as great for them because it'll get them into more enterprises potentially because Salesforce has so many more enterprise customers than Slack does. And, you know, if Salesforce is really going to integrate it as part of the way they communicate internally among employees and externally with customers, then that's great for Slack. Slack is, you know, I wouldn't say foundering, but it's very much the small fish compared to Microsoft Teams.
Yeah, Microsoft is giving away Teams, though, right?
I mean, that's the thing, though. It's easy for Microsoft to come around and just dump Teams in your lap, whether or not you use it. Slack has to actually fight to land. And now if you're already a Salesforce customer, they get to come in through the back door.
That's right. And it also sets up an interesting thing because Cisco, with its WebEx and, you know, IBM's got a version of this and all those other tools that are all those other, you know, historical IT vendors are really not getting a look in here in this space. It's really going to be just Teams versus Slack. And yep. I don't even think that Teams is fairly awful. Nobody actually says that Teams is fantastic. They go like, it's okay. It works generally, you know, whereas people who use Slack generally like its simplicity, but there is a lot more it could do if it was integrated. And if it was integrated with Salesforce, for the companies that use Salesforce, there might be some value that they can add. The market doesn't particularly hate it, but I don't think they equally love it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, the question for all these kind of acquisitions is, can the buyer actually integrate and expand what they've bought without killing it? And, you know, I guess I feel like Salesforce probably knows the value of this thing they bought, and so they're going to be good with it. If somebody like Google bought it, I'd feel a little bit more worried.
Yeah. I'd be worried if somebody like HP or Dell or Cisco bought it. That would be, right. And I mean, it does have to be said that Salesforce is pretty bad with acquisitions. It makes a number of acquisitions, generally doesn't integrate them well, and then sort of treats them like the bastard stepson, and then they sort of wither away and die over a period of time, but they've possibly served whatever corporate purpose there was in the acquisition. But I think in this case, they're at the price that they're spending, Benioff is going to have to make sure that he leverages this in some way to really spike Salesforce's revenue, because Salesforce's growth is zero. And it's really the way that it's typically spiked its share price and kept its shareholders happy is by going out and buying companies like Slack. And that only works so many times. That's a well you can only go to so many times before your cash flow runs out. So there's a lot to be going against this, and it'll be interesting to see. And, you know, at the end of the day, Microsoft, of all companies, the least competent of the enterprise IT vendors, was able to beat Slack at its own game by and large. Now, albeit with a product that's not particularly good, has very little features, and they're giving it away for free, which is probably all that it's worth, you know, still Slack.
But Microsoft has the numbers and the position. They've got the enterprise customers.
So. Challenge. I'm quite concerned for our use of Slack. I'm a big Slack fan. You know, we use it to operate our business. Quite honestly, I think you know, Discord's starting to look pretty good.
I guess if you're looking for that independent flavor,
I just want something that does the job. I don't actually want it to be integrated with things that, like, the Teams integrations are more problems than they're worth. So.
Right. I mean, for us, if Salesforce wanted to now come along and start shoehorning in CRM features that we absolutely don't need, that would be a problem. We just want Slack to be our chat.
Or if they double the price because it's a Salesforce product now, or triple the price.
Right. Yes. So my big question is, who's going to buy Zoom? That's the other big workforce collaboration star, particularly in this work from home distributed workforce era. So who's going to
see? I don't think Zoom's buyable at the current valuation. It's just, you know, like it's just got so much value. People are expecting it to grow much further. So any sort of buyout would have to pay, you know, way more than $27 billion, I think.
Oh, yeah. It would have to be an enormous purchase.
And I'm not sure that, you know, Teams would say, well, we've already got something. Amazon's got Chime. I mean, that's rubbish, of course, but that's never stopped him. You know, the question is who would buy it? I'm not sure that there's an obvious buyer for that. Oracle, maybe? But I doubt it. They've got lots of
Oracle, maybe.
You know, they have a whole product suite of telephony and video tools that they've been selling to people. So,
right, Google has the cash, or at least has the share.
Well, they've already got Google Meet. Why would they buy Zoom? They'd say we've already got a product. We wouldn't, you know,
right? Because it's terrible.
And buying customers, you know, if you want to buy buy the revenue, buy the customer base, I'm not sure that Google would see the value in that.
I don't anticipate that Google will, because I just don't get the sense they're serious about anything other than search.
And YouTube, so, which is still search. Yeah.
Right, and YouTube. Mm. Yeah. Yeah. All right, moving on. In other news, HPE signaled the end of an era when it announced it would relocate its headquarters from Silicon Valley to Houston, Texas. HPE's famed for being one of the iconic garage startups in Silicon Valley. HPE says the move to Houston will, frankly, save money.
Pretty blunt, too. Not even trying to obfuscate it. It's just a straight-up money-saving move. The story isn't actually news as such. If you're a HPE employee, they've already moved heavily to move employees away from Silicon Valley over a sustained period. Mm-hmm. And most people found that business units have been relocating to Texas for quite some time. And this is more of an official announcement after the fact than an actual, we're going to do it. It's already been done. HPE has been building a campus out there. They've been moving entire business units out there for a number of years. And it's been flat out just because the cost of hiring staff there is so much cheaper. And of course, that's where Compaq was back in the day. So they already had a substantial footprint of headcount and infrastructure and campuses. And they started building another campus. And I believe their new campus in Houston will be finished. In the release, it said, Houston has long been our largest U.S. employment hub, and construction has been underway since the beginning of the year on a new state-of-the-art campus in the area. And so I think that's the key thing here, is that they've already moved most of the stuff there. The second part is they had great financial results. We'll touch on that at the end of the show very quickly, but they had a great quarter, really way over the odds for the numbers. So announcing a HQ move against the backdrop of a 5 to 10% jump in sales and profits is like, good, don't notice the little things sort of thing. So I thought that was there.
Right.
lots of people are bemoaning and I go, they're losing behind their roots. I'm going like, HP is still there. So if you want to buy printers and laptops, that company's still there. HP is the enterprise IT division and it was never anything to do with the garage, I don't think.
Yeah, probably not, but still interesting.
People, you've got to stop being attached to history. So what? And you've got to stop being attached to Silicon Valley. There's no magic superpowers in the water, or mostly Silicon Valley is just full of toxic wasteland where they were manufacturing silicon back in the 1960s. And most of the farmland around there has actually been poisoned with runoff from the production plant.
Well, there may be, I guess, a little magic still for them in Silicon Valley, because HP said that the Aruba business unit is going to retain its HQ San Jose.
And that makes sense because networking is still very much a center there. The transfer of staff between the networking companies, Juniper, Cisco, Broadcom, it's more of a revolving door than any sort of sense of loyalty between most of the people who live in that sort of area. And I think that makes sense for the time being. Mm-hmm. And those people tend to be networking is a much more niche industry, whereas HPE is a much more general purpose. It's got storage, it's got servers and services and GreenLake and financial services and so forth. So different story for HPE than it would be for the networking. So, and maybe those buildings that they've got have got a, 5 year, 10 year, 20 year lease on them. It makes no sense to wear that cost and try and walk away.
I'm curious to see if Antonio Neri, who's the CEO of HPE, came from Aruba. I wonder if he'll stay in Silicon Valley or if he'll go too.
I don't think it matters. In an era of distributed work, I think where people live, just because you live in a, here or there or wherever, it matters much less now than it did 2 years ago.
Yes. Although there is still, I guess, some kind of psychic resonance of where you're located. And
it's definitely as someone who's not a US person but deals with a lot of people from the USA, they love to talk about where they're from as if that's some sort of flag for something, right? They always say like, I'm from such and such. And I have no idea. I don't know American geography at all and have no willingness to take the time to understand that, as far as I know, Texas is somewhere in the middle. That's about it, right? But apparently if you're from Texas, that's got some significant emotional baggage associated with it that I'm supposed to comprehend.
Well, maybe not you, but other Americans are supposed to, yes.
Yes, but, it's not all about America anymore. We live in a global world. Anyway.
All right, moving on. Last month, the IETF announced that it had secured 6 years of funding from the Internet Society to support the IETF's continuing efforts to promote technical standards. The Internet Society is going to provide $41 million to the IETF for core operations, plus provide matching contributions for the IETF's own fundraising efforts.
Yeah, this is concerning and good news at the same time. The Internet Society has been funding the IETF for some time. And the Internet Society, of course, funds a number of different businesses around. But the way that they structure them is they run them all as either nonprofits or local corporations in the US. Nearly all of them are registered in California. And the IETF is probably the most unique in the sense that its standards are in the open. Unlike, say, ANSI, the American National Standards Institute, or the IEEE, both of which are actually for-profit businesses. So that is, they are standards bodies, but membership fees have to be charged. And if you want to access the data from the standards, you have to either pay to access them or you have to pay to be a member. and most, and that creates a whole culture of how do I get my money back from this membership?
Yep.
Does that make sense? Whereas the ITF is very much a more of an open source participatory. If you participate, that's your capital. You're investing, you know, that's right. your contribution right. sort of thing. And I can't help but wonder that if the ITF runs out of funding, and part of a key part, of course, of the ITF is that its conferences, the ITF congresses, or the meetings that it have, they have three a year, was a major source of funding for them. And that has now gone away, of course, in the right. pandemic era, and likely will never come back. And they need new revenue sources. So at least this underpins the revenue that they have and continues the funding that the Internet Society has given them in the past. But I'm very concerned that the ITF might start going down the special membership club path of all the other ones, like the IEEE, the Ethernet Alliance. You know, so many of these open source projects, they have platinum members and gold memberships, and those people get privileges and they get to be able to take the projects in the direction they want. Whereas the ITF is very much for the people, not for
yeah, and they take that literally. I mean, we've had Russ White on the show on various shows to talk about the IETF and the fact that you, the person listening right now, can become an IETF member and go and participate in the development of standards if you have the time and inclination. They're looking for people to help them out. It is an open, collaborative body.
Yeah, I suspect that the IETF would not survive if it actually became a special members club and you had to pay substantial fees. It would exclude, you know, substantial numbers of people from various countries around the world. And you'd end up with another IEEE. And basically the IEEE exists to make sure that companies who have patents in the area get their patents into the standard so they can make friend patent revenues. And that is not ideal,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah, so the good news is the IETF will continue in its current form thanks to some funding from Internet Society.
Still needs more money, though. Not enough. Yeah. It's only partial.
Yeah. So if you want to contribute, you can also do that. Links in the show notes to find out more. We'll move on. Dell has announced new techniques and services to protect its products across the supply chain from tampering and misuse. These new services include tamper evidence seals on PC boxes and pallets when they're shipped from a factory, and a data sanitation service that will wipe hard drives before they're shipped to customers.
Weirdly, this is not a default service. This is an extra service that you have to ask for and pay for, presumably.
I was reading the press release and I'm like, the way they're phrasing this sounds like I have to request this and then pay for it, when it seems like I yes. should be getting this as part of the price.
I would have, yes. Wouldn't you want your customers to trust yes. your product? But no, if you want to trust that the product you got is actually the product that you bought, you now have to pay extra, which is a hell of a scam when you put it like that.
It's like they've got Trust Basic, you know, which is the basic level. And then if you want Trust Premium or Trust Platinum, then you got to pony up.
Yeah, and that, which is an odd way to approach it, in the sense that I guess Dell wants to keep the prices on its products as low as possible, and if you want the supply chain integrity, you have to pony up. But that sounds very strange to me, because at the end of the day, the supply chain is the supply chain. And if you try to add supply chain integrity on top, then it doesn't make sense, because then the supply chain is not inherently secure, right? So if I'm buying a pallet worth of gear and it's being shipped out of Vietnam, and so you add some tamper-proof sticky tape around the outside of the pallet, that doesn't sound like much of a service. Maybe I'm missing something here. But
I mean, now that we're talking about it, I'm thinking about it, it's almost like, I don't want to say extortionary because that's a little too strong, but sort of like it sure would be a shame if your computers arrived and they had malware on them and you didn't pay to clean them.
Yeah, so there's that. Basically, they're tamper-proof sticky labels and seals on equipment that's being shipped to your premises to suggest that it's not being tampered with in transit. The second part about this is they're also offering a service for the destruction and sanitization of disks on premise. Those services already exist anywhere in the world. There are companies who will come on site with a special truck, and they will pulverize your hard drives into dust.
And I think
want.
It's fair to charge for something like that, because there are costs associated with disposal. Yeah. So, of course, you have to recoup that. But the supply chain security seems to me should be a key feature. That's a cost you take on by selling you the product.
That's right. How hard is it just to put some tamper-proof stickers on a box? I'm not 100% sure why it's extra. And the last one is they're also doing something to improve the UEFI and BIOS security. We've seen a number of security vulnerabilities. We don't talk about security on this show, but there's a number of security vulnerabilities, and the bot crews are now starting to put in attacks that actually detect the BIOS or the UEFI to get persistence on the service. So even after you reboot them, or even if I wipe the hard drive and start again, they can regain control of the server. So TrickBot, for example, a very popular piece of malware to get access to machines for ransomware, is now including some tools around this that was talked about this week. So they're doing some tools to do that. Again, that sounds like a standard feature. This shouldn't be an added extra. So some questions there. If we're misunderstanding, please do get in contact. We have a follow-up capability, packetpushers.net/FU. We'd love to hear more if you've looked into this. But of course, it's all against the background of the geopolitical tensions between the USA, China, and Russia, of course, where they're all there's lots of push against each other. And we're also seeing a step up of the criminal gangs doing more and more to try and get inside your networks. So if I was an enterprise and wanting to be sure that my servers hadn't been tampered with in transit before I got them, then maybe this is a service that you want.
Yeah, again, packetpushers.net/FU. If you do have some more insight on this, we'd love to make sure we're being clear about it. But off the top of my head, I'm like, I feel like I should be getting this as part of my regular purchase price. All right, let's take a quick break to hear from Nokia. Did you know that Nokia has over 1.1 million routers deployed and power some of the largest interconnection networks like Equinix and DECIX? Recently, Nokia launched its data center fabric solution. This is building on over 20 years of IP know-how and expertise. The new DC fabric solution includes SR Linux. This is a new, open, extensible, resilient network operating system. It's based on standard Linux, and it's using Nokia's field-proven protocol stacks and provides best-in-class streaming telemetry. There's also interconnect routers. This is a portfolio of Leaf Spine and Super Spine platforms using merchant silicon, and the Fabric Services platform, a declarative intent-based automation and operations toolkit for day zero, day one, and day two plus operations. The Fabric Services platform uses Kubernetes and a distributed microservices approach, so you get a true cloud-native automation and operations platform. There are certified design templates and a digital sandbox for true emulation of your data center fabric, so operators can automate their data center networks at scale and speed with confidence. We did a podcast with Nokia on heavy networking, episode 538, on this if you want to hear about more, or just check out their data center fabric solution at nokia.com/networks/dc-fabric. That is nokia.com/networks/dc-fabric. Right, back to the news. Fortinet is offering cloud consulting services for AWS deployments to help customers with the design and ensure they follow best practices.
Yeah, this interesting service in the sense that if you're moving into AWS, Fortinet wants to be there to help you to have their services on top of AWS, of course, against a backdrop of AWS offering application firewalls like we saw last week and a range of firewall services, albeit at eye-wateringly generous prices for them, not for you, of course. I think it's a not unreasonable offering. And the interesting part is that it actually comes directly from Fortinet. Now, I've been outspoken across packet pushers that I think the reseller model is probably broken and largely obsolete. There are some positives to the reseller model, but there's mostly negatives as we move forward into an era of the internet. Why do we need to have local people, local resources? Why it will be generally better served if you need access to a specific skill or a niche skill or some specific expertise, then you should be able to draw on it. And really, that should come from a vendor who has that niche skill. And I also maintain that the complement to this is that most IT teams should not have resellers providing IT skills. They should do it themselves in-house. They would be better off having more staff. Now, some people call that DevOps. If you want to call it DevOps as to having more staff in-house to do IT, that's fine by me. But you still may need to access specific skills. And to my mind, accessing it directly from the vendor makes sense. So this sort of, in this case, Fortinet Cloud Security Consulting delivers design, architecture, automation, and implementation services. Click here, you know, on the AWS marketplace, and they'll be there to help you. That seems reasonable to me.
Absolutely. I think it's smart for Fortinet to do it. A little customer handholding in the cloud, maybe an opportunity for them to sell a few more licenses for virtual instances of Fortinet products. So, and also the way to, you know, sort of ingratiate yourself with your customer being a trusted partner makes total sense that Fortinet's doing this, and curious to see if other vendors are following suit.
And developers on the AWS marketplace, they're not thinking, oh, I'll ring up my local reseller to sell me to help me. They just want to do it all on AWS, right?
Right. I assume this is an organization coming in after the developers have gone into AWS and started building stuff and are like, whoa, wait.
Yeah.
Hold on.
Hang on. You know, I've got to put I've been told I have to put a Fortinet firewall in here, but nobody knows how to make a Fortinet firewall go on AWS. Click here and Fortinet will help me type thing. Yep. Right? Now, I believe that this sort of consulting and service is best provided by the vendor, but historically people believe it should come from resellers, and I think that model is now well and truly in a coffin. And, you know, there's only a zombie part of it walking around.
Yeah. I mean, I would love to see IT hire more folks to be able to do more stuff in-house. It's for the best. But
if only to give themselves a break. Well, if you go from two people in your networking team to three, that's a 33% increase in, you know, 50% increase in capacity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But as of course we know, organizations don't like to carry things like salary and whatever other obligations there are on the books. So that's why we have the model we do.
You know, bad IT managers are everywhere. It's just numbers, right? On a spreadsheet and justifications.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Don't buy that that upgraded storage array. Hire some headcount.
There you go. All right, Broadcom, they've announced new chips in their Tomahawk and Trident families. On the Tomahawk forefront, two new chips are going to offer 100 gig ports at 25.6 and 12.8 terabytes of throughput, which complements the existing 50 gig port offering. The company also announced the availability of the Trident Smart Top of Rack or Smart Tor, which the company is positioning for L4 to L7 use cases like load balancing, packet brokering, and so on.
Yeah, in the world's most opaque set of press releases. I think I could hand that out as an award. The press releases really don't actually spell out what's happening here, but as best as I can tell, the announcement is that the Trident 4 chipset has had a bit of a bump and it now does some more of what it already did, bigger and better than it did before, and it's shipping in volume. So there was a pre-announcement around the Trident 4 at the beginning of the year, and it's now shipping in volume if you actually want to go and buy one. In other words, race out and buy it. The Tomahawk 4, I think, was a much more substantial announcement because they're now announcing two new chips, which now include 256 by 100 gig PAM4s and another model, which is a 12.8 terabit per second, which is 128 by 100 gig PAM4s. So that is a 100 gig, 400 gig switch unit. So, and potentially even an 800 gig if you slice and dice the 100 gig lanes into the ways that you want them. And they're talking about the Tomahawk and the Trident being suitable for the enterprise, although I don't think the enterprise is going to be racing into 100 gig. And then there was also the announcement to complement this, which is they're also announcing a Phi chip, which is now 800 gig ready. And it's a 7-nanometer, 8 by 100 gig PAM4 Phi. So they actually have this Phi chip that you can now take to your line cards, and that is an 800 gig Phi. So that 8 by 100 gig lanes. Each lane obviously is clocking at 125 gigabits per second to give you 100 gig of Ethernet. It's using PAM4 for the modulation. So basically it's Broadcom rounding out their portfolio for 2020. And as they go into 2021, they're getting ready to say, we're here for 400 gig, 100 gig, 400 gig, and 800 gig.
Something that jumped out to me about the Trident Smart Tor is the way they positioned it as essentially a competitor to general purpose processors and FPGAs that might be doing things like load balancing, VXLAN gateways, NATing, other security functions. It seems like they are now wanting to get into this space where we've seen activity from NVIDIA and others promoting smart NICs for general purpose, for offloading security and networking functions.
Yeah, I think the Trident is the chipset that they would like to see go to the enterprise. So that's the maximum amount of flexibility and features, but much lower performance. So in terms of raw horsepower, latency and buffers and capabilities, it's much slower. That I think is the pitch that they're trying to make to that. Whether that's going to stick or not, I don't know. I mean, at this point in time, I don't think Broadcom's doing enough to attract the enterprise to its offerings to understand the value of the ASIC. They're not selling the silicon, if you know what I'm saying. They're generally giving it to somebody else and saying, go and turn it into a switch.
Right, whatever. Right. They did mention having a software-defined pipeline for switching routing in the L4, L7 use cases for this Trident Smart Tor, which seems like, you know, they're reaching out to the enterprise.
They've already got that. Yeah, they've already got that, right? They've already had a programmable pipeline since the Trident 2. The Trident 1 was fixed. The Trident 2 started to follow that trend as the, you know, the P4 programmable pipeline got traction and people wanted to be able to program the forwarding path, at least partially. Generally, the story that I generally hear is that people don't want to program every packet. What they want to be able to do is program 10% of the flows through the switch to do a particular thing.
But I guess my larger point was that we know that Broadcom also makes it hard to access the software you would need to do the programming. And that's not going to help if they really want to get to enterprise customers.
Yeah. So I don't think enterprise, you know, they're selling products to enterprise. Anyway, the marketing message is confused, I think. And I struggled to decode the press releases, for sure. Wish I had ever had a presentation and maybe that would have been more helpful. Yeah.
All All right, moving on. Recently, Comcast announced that starting January 1st, it's going to enforce monthly broadband caps of 1.2 terabytes on customers who don't subscribe to its unlimited data plan. Customers who exceed the limit will be charged for additional blocks in 50 gigabyte chunks. The caps are going to affect 14 states and the District of Columbia.
So against the era of distributed work and people working remotely, or whatever you want to call it, Comcast is obviously looking to squeeze more money out of its existing customer base. These caps were announced four or five years ago, and there was all, you know, like no customer would ever, this is just an excessive cap. And of course, as time's gone by, 1.2 terabytes is pretty much standard for a lot of customers, especially if you start working from home. This is all directly attributable to the demise of net neutrality led by FCC Commissioner Ajit Pai. And I think that a lot of people who might have sort of thought, well, it was okay, might be starting to regret. So if you've now got to go back to Comcast and say, we need to upgrade so that I can work from home, that seems to be an impost or an unnecessary taxation, like a business tax effectively on people. It's not really necessary that I could see. I don't know what you think.
I mean, I think it's not a great look during a pandemic when broadband is literally a lifeline for work, for school, for access to healthcare, for access to mental health treatment, all that stuff. And now you're going to be capping folks. I get it. You know, people need to pay for services, but Comcast is rich. It's doing fine. Squeezing customers like this is just, particularly during this time, they can get away with it because we lack competition in the United States, and I've ridden this horse around too many times, but that's the crux of it.
Yeah. I think Comcast has been clever here. They've been slow to leverage the net neutrality rollback. So Ajit Pai, you know, smashed the net neutrality thing late last year. And Comcast hasn't really rushed into it because there was a substantial pushback by the US citizenry. Mm-hmm. The other backdrop here is that I was reading another blog, Pots and Pans, there's a link in the show notes, and he's talking about research that shows big growth in broadband customers with now over 1.5 million new broadband subscriber customers added by the big ISPs over the last quarter. So Comcast is taking advantage of the situation to squeeze more out of the same customers against a background of rising demand. And, good or bad, I don't know.
Well, I'm going to say bad.
Good from a capitalist point of view, but I think it's bad for a lot of people.
I mean, it's not even capitalist. It's duopolistic is what it is. So we can't even say it's a capitalist move. But
anyway, so that's an interesting one.
Yeah, there you go.
Interesting one.
All right, quick break to tell you about our other sponsor, Linode. Whether you're working on a personal project or managing enterprise infrastructure, you deserve simple, affordable, and accessible cloud computing solutions to take your project to the next level. You can simplify your cloud infrastructure with Linode's Linux virtual machines and develop, deploy, and scale your modern apps faster and easier. And you can get started with $100 in free credit. You can find the details at linode.com/networkbreak. They've got 11 global data centers. They provide 24/7/365 human support. There are no tiers or handoffs, regardless of your plan size. You get dedicated compute instances, and you can use your $100 in credit on S3 compatible object storage, manage Kubernetes, and more. So host your website, build your app, store or backup media. It's up to you. And you can start with $100 in free credit. So check out linode.com/networkbreak. Click on the create free account button and get started. And check out Linode's YouTube channel for video tutorials, security tips, and more. That's youtube.com/Linode. All right, we just mentioned Ajit Pai in a related story. He has announced he's pre-announced his resignation. It's time to coincide with the inauguration of Joe Biden as U.S. president on January 20th of 2021. Pai could have stayed on as a commissioner for the FCC until June of 2021, but it's likely that Biden would have selected someone else to be a chair, so he's stepping down and stepping out.
Yeah, which, you know, seemed entirely reasonable. You know, I thought when it was first announced, he sort of said, well, I was appointed by Trump. Now with Trump going, I should go too. And it wasn't until I found a completely unrelated article that pointed out that, in fact, the Republican Party might have actually forced him to stand down so that they could select somebody to replace him. And when the FCC commissioners are appointed, they get a guaranteed term. And they want to appoint a new commissioner before the president moves out of the White House, so that they can maintain political control of the FCC for the next 4 years.
So yeah, and I should say Ajit Pai, I think, was appointed by Trump. He was on the FCC board during the Obama administration. He may have been elevated to chair, but I think he's been chair for a long time.
Okay. Then I take that back. But nonetheless, he is all appearances here are that he is stepping down early, claiming that he wants to move on, probably to a job in the telco
sector. I'm sure he's going to go on to a very lucrative career somewhere else, yes.
Yes, advisory career. But it also appears to be a political move, which may be a problem because, you know, as we've talked about, there is a fair bit of, you know, things going on with the openness of the internet, net neutrality. I believe that the Biden presidency has announced that they would like to seek reinstatement of net neutrality. Mm. And so the Republican Party may be working hard to try and take control of that issue and to fill that seat with a person of their own persuasion rather than letting the incoming government, you know, take control as would be normal.
Yeah. So the way it works is there are supposed to be five commissioners and they're appointed by the president, but the U.S. Senate gets to confirm at present. If this new person who's taking over for Ajit Pai gets confirmed, that will be 4-4, two Dems, two Republicans, and Biden could appoint a fifth. But if the Senate doesn't confirm him, which is entirely possible, then we'd have essentially a deadlock in the FCC, which would be hard to make new policy then going forward.
That's right. Yeah. So, you know, tough for the US market. And by certain standards, things that the FCC do have impact globally as well, although perhaps less so as we go forward. The FCC is diverging from what is consistent with global best practice in many areas. Certainly Europe is all into net neutrality and several other countries in the Asian regions. Yeah.
Anyway, lots of links in the show notes if you want to read up on it yourself. Let's finish the episode with HPE's Q4 financial results. They had their fourth quarter 2020, which had revenues of $7.2 billion for the quarter, which was flat year over year. But Greg, you said they had a good quarter nonetheless.
Yeah, blew the socks off just about every single part of it. I think we've covered them fairly solidly over the last 2 years as they've gotten smaller. You know, obviously the spin out of Micro Focus. And then the Micro Focus business, of which HPE maintains a substantial shareholding, has been consistently devalued as those business units have failed to fire in the new format, which has dragged down HPE's share price because so much of the value was tied up in that company. And so for them to be able to turn it around, particularly the one that caught my eye, there's lots of good news in there. They sold less servers, but everything else grew, networking, storage. But storage grew 7% sequentially to $1.2 billion. We also expanded our operating profit to 16.7%. So they actually sold more storage and increased the profit margin on storage to 16.7%, which is a 380 basis point sequentially. That's astonishing. In storage, good old tedious, boring storage. So yeah, it's interesting to read the rest of it and see what else they did, but it was pretty boggling to see some of the results.
Yeah, just to note the Intelligent Edge unit, which is Aruba, they had revenues of $786 million, up 6% year over year, and their compute revenue was $3.2 billion.
Yeah, and up 15% from the previous quarter. And the headline that HP threw out to analysts was, "We return to pre-pandemic levels of revenue at $7.2 billion, up 6% from the last quarter and flat from the prior year period." So that's as good as you'll talk about. And all the other numbers are good too, cash flow, GAAP, earnings per share, blah, blah, blah. So the markets are very happy with HP right now. So as I said at the top of the show, probably this is a good time to announce you're moving your HQ because while the numbers are good, nobody's going to really pay attention.
Yes, under the cover of darkness there, shipping out to Houston.
That's it, yes.
Well, good luck with the move. Moving is always difficult, so hope everybody handles it well. Mm. All right, that wraps up our show. Greg, where can folks find more from you?
I am doing a lot of posting on the Twitters at the moment. So why don't you try and follow me on the Twitter as at Ethereal Mind. A little bit of snark, a little bit of fun, and also hot links and information as I find it.
Yep. I'm Drew Conroy Murray. I'm on Twitter at Drew_CM and blogging at packetpushers.net. Thanks to Linode and Nokia for sponsoring the show. And thank you, as always, for joining us for Network Break. If you like the show, tell a friend on whatever your favorite platform is. You could leave a recommendation on Apple Podcasts. That really helps as well. And check out our membership program, ignition.packetpushers.net. As always, thanks for listening.